Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now.
Productions, one of the few Black-owned radio programs that focus on solutions in the Black community, presents Black Urban America. All you folks that listen by laptops, you can dial 516-531-9540 and press 1 if you have a comment or a question. That's 516-531-9540 and press 1 if you have a comment. The lineup, as usual, starting on the first Monday of December, every Monday we have Black Economics Freedom by Greg Ruffin. On Tuesdays, myself, my name is Kenny Jones, host of Black Urban America. On Wednesday, we have The Cutting Edge with Michonne Williams. On Thursday, every other Thursday, part of Port of Harlem Magazine by Wade Young. And finishing up, we have Saturdays, we have Provocative Thought with Carlton Steve. Tonight, we have a special guest. This guest is an author. I read her book. It is very, very enlightening. She's a poet. She's an independent journalist as well as a writer. She's a culture art producer. And she's the co-founder of SWAM, or SWAM, which stands for Spoken Word, Art, and Music. She just published the book called I hope I'm saying this word right, The Orsha Talks, Tales of Lust, Love, and Historical Memory. And her book discusses four generations of Black L.A. coming from a ancient African philosophical thought. And I hope I say her name right. Her name is Tricia
Koshe.
Tricia Amia Koshe. Sister Koshe, that's the easiest. That's the easiest name out of the three. welcome, Welcome to Black Over America. How you doing this evening?
Thank you. I'm doing great. Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Okay, let's get right into it. I got a lot of things I would like to ask you about your book and everything. I completed the reading and what have you. And it's a few questions we're going to dive into tonight. And some of it's going to be personal.
Okay.
And some are going to be the spiritual. And it seems to me from reading your book that a lot of it is almost autobiography dealing with the African spirituality and poetry.
Yes. You talk about your great-great-grandmother, Aunt Annie.
You talk about your father, your grandfather. You talk about generations, how Black LA used to be, which we're going to cover this evening. But first of all, I'd like to ask you, how do you pronounce O-R-I-S-H-A?
Orisha. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. What is the Orisha?
Yes. The Orisha is like the high God.
It's not a God, but the high manifestation of all of the manifestations.
The Orisha are like, some people call them deities. They're the forces of nature. So each Orisha represents some kind of element of nature. So like most people are familiar with, let's say, Oshun or Yemanya. Both of those Orishas represent the water element, right? Yemanya represents the oceans. And she's also like the mother figure because, you know, as we know, we couldn't survive without water. Right, so
yeah, we could survive without food, but we can't survive without water. We can go 7 days without food.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Oh shoot, we can go longer than that. I've done fast for maybe 3 weeks without food, but I just did, you know, like vegetable juice and water. But
okay.
Yeah, we can go a long time without food, but not without water.
How long can you go without food, Michonne? Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse my manners. On the line also, we have Michonne Williams, who is the host of The Cutting Edge, which is one of the shows
yes.
of We Talk Production. And Michonne, this
okay.
is Sister Coche from California, you know, and
that's
the author of, and she's going to be chiming in on some questions too. But be sure, how long can you go without food? 1 hour?
Ooh, probably 3 days.
Huh?
3 days at the top. So far.
You went 3 days without food?
Yes.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, we got a bunch of fasting people on the line tonight. Okay. Grace, Sister Koshi. Koshi.
Okay,
now, Is the Orisha an African belief system?
Yes. So
you go anywhere in Africa and they practicing the spirituality. Where did it start from?
I would not just anywhere in Africa, along the West Coast. Nigeria, Angola, that region, which is actually where a lot of us here in the diaspora were taken from.
Right. My people are from Western part of Nigeria. Yeah.
Right.
Do you know any conflicts that happen between your spirituality belief system, and I know that there are a lot of Nigerians that believe in Islam and as well as Christianity. Is there any time there's conflicts in that country?
Conflicts between the religions or the people?
The religions.
What's the? Well, my whole thesis in the book is really saying that people have demonized traditional African religions, right? And so
right.
that's been for political reasons, also for just, you know, because to me, all religious, so-called religious wars are really about trying to take people's land and resources. And so people will come up with reasons why I don't like these people over here, because they do such and such. But it's really, bottom line is, you just want to take their land or their resources. And so that's a major reason why traditional African religions have been demonized, is because people wanted that land. People wanted that cheap labor. People wanted the resources. And so we're just going to say these people are, you know, infidels or pagans or whatever. So
right.
we can go ahead
Cannibals.
And
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And I really want to make the point of saying, you know, traditional African religions don't even have the concept of the devil or anything like that.
Right.
And so when people say, well, you're doing the devil stuff, or what, that's not even a concept within the tradition or within the philosophy. And so what I put in the book is like, look, these, some, as I said, some people call them deities. I call them the forces of nature. And the whole point that I put in the, that I try to get across in the book, is that that is one level. If you go to a deeper level, it's really about the human psychology and human personality. That African philosophy is very deep. And you can look at it on the surface level and say, oh, it's one thing. People are worshiping trees and this and that. But you take it to that deeper level, and it is very deep. It goes,
again, conscious mind, too, and the humanity of one thought.
Exactly.
And
so
when you
look
at the definition of all the elements of the language of the Orisha, you know, it looked like characteristics that portray in a human being.
Exactly. The human personality, the human psychology, especially when you read the stories of the different Orishas, and you're like, you know what, this is some human stuff going on here, right? But I think the lessons that we could learn from the stories of the Orishas is how they come together and cooperate and work together, even with all of their, you know, jealousies and difficulties, and so-and-so was married to this person, now they with this person. But, you know, that's some human stuff going on, right? But yet
right.
they're still able to come together, to cooperate and work together and do what they need to do to serve. And that's the bottom line, is that the Orishas are there to serve and guide humanity. And they do that through their teachings. And, you know, each Orisha has their own personality, their own dances, their own characteristics. And there's, like we were saying, there's good and bad. And again, that just goes to show you about the choices that we make in our life. And that's
what
the
Orishas represent. Why is, I can't say this word, I'm just going to spell it, E-L-E-G-B-A. Okay. Why is that thing, the messenger between humanity and the Most High, out of all the other labels, why is that the why is he the messenger? And he's a he, right?
Elegba Eshu. He represents the crossroads. You know, there's that old story about Robert Johnson, the blues man.
Yeah,
he was at
the crossroads.
You know, and so really, again, going back to what I said earlier, is that Eshu is not the devil. He presents you with opportunities and choices, whether you're going to go to the right, the left, or you're going to go straight, right? So it's up to you as the individual, the choices that you make, because every choice has its good and bad, its consequences, right? And that's what Eshu represents. And so that's why he's the first Orisha that is spoken to, because he's the one that will remove the obstacles for you or open the road and provide you with opportunities.
Okay. All right.
So that's what
now,
he represents.
I've got another question. I got
okay.
many questions. Why is there only one Boreal?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Why is there only one Boreal? Shango.
I'm sorry.
Why is there only one Boreal? It seemed like there's only one warrior. Like, everybody else is about peace, love, the Most High, the ocean, the water. Everybody's into that calmness, that coolness. But you only got one warrior. You got to protect the
No,
one.
Actually, we got several warriors.
I only saw one. That was Sean Go.
Ogun. Ogun. Ogun rides. In fact, the three warriors, after Eshu comes Ogun, who rides into battle with Aya, and also Ochasi. I'm probably mispronouncing that myself. But those Orishas all have warrior energy. And in fact, Oya, the poems that I write under Oya are very much represent that warrior energy. Because Oya is the storm, right? She's
right.
The whirlwind.
Okay.
She's the
storm.
She's
okay.
Yeah, she's, she's the kick-ass, right? She's Foxy Brown, you know?
Yeah, you see. Hey, I know y'all love that, don't y'all? I know y'all love that takeover. Now, I'm going to switch the questioning right now. A little bit about the city dynamic, the historical city dynamics of L.A., Black L.A.,
mm-hmm.
to quote you, Black
mm-hmm.
L.A., for generations.
Mm-hmm.
Why were Angelenas so full of optimism at one time? And why were they full of optimism back then? And are they full of optimism now?
Good questions. Well, I would think it didn't just happen in LA. See, that part of that whole Black migration out of the South was about optimism and knowing that we could get better jobs in the Midwest. You know, people went to Chicago, people went to
Detroit.
New York, and Detroit, and people went to California. From, you know, in California mainly we have, what, people from Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas. But I have two on both sides of my family. I have people that came from out of Texas. But on the other side
Your
of the great, family,
great grandmother,
I have people
right?
that.
Aunt Annie?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I have people that came from Ohio. And the folks from Ohio, they were actually friends. They were educated. They had been free people for quite some time, and they were educated. and they were friends with Du Bois. And so it was Du Bois that suggested that they go to California. One of the brothers had breathing problems, and so he needed to get into a better climate. And if you can imagine, before all the freeways and cars, L.A. did have some clean air.
Right. And I heard a lot of the freeway, and this is documented, a lot of the freeway went through black neighborhoods.
Oh, definitely. It was almost, you know, shall we say by design that that's what happened. There was an area in black L.A. called Sugar Hill where a lot of the black celebrities lived at the time. And, yeah, that 10 freeway went straight through that part of town. And then in Santa Monica, the same thing happened there. People don't know that there were black folks living in the beach areas. As well, in Venice, you had Oakwood, and then areas in Santa Monica as well.
So you also describe that California at one time had a diversified economy. What happened?
Mm-hmm.
What happened to California's diversified economy?
Yeah, that's what a lot of folks are saying. What happened? Reaganomics happened. You had people that got into political office and literally just plundered the resources and moved the money where they wanted it to go. And, of course, a lot of that was also happening when, you know, jobs left the community, the economy was changing.
What did you think of Tom Brown?
What
did you think of Tom Brown?
Well, I was really, you know, was younger when he was in office, so I don't really have personal experience with that. I've heard some good things. You know, he did really groom a lot of black political folks and really trained a lot of people under him. That's how a lot of people got their experience, was in his administration. So I think that was a good thing. I think it's, anyone that gets into political office, that's a whole nother kind of conversation, because, you know, you are really in the belly of the beast when you get into politics. So
That's a whole nother conversation. I want to ask you something personal now. You was walking on the beach. You was dancing on the beach as a young girl. Hold up. Wait till the question.
No, I wasn't
you
dancing,
was dancing
on the beach.
On the beach.
I was running.
As a young girl, and this older man was eyeing you down, which made you feel a little uncomfortable. He sent his daughter over so you could dance for him and what have you. And you got cool with the ex-wife and everything. Now I'm going to ask you a personal question. How do you feel about older men coming on to younger women? You brought it up
now,
in the
wait
book,
a second
man.
Now. Now, wait a second now. Let's
you
make it clear.
It you brought it up in the book, man.
Let's explain that completely. No, his wife was a dance instructor. And
yeah,
so he said, yes. She taught Egyptian dance, and he was like, you would make a good dancer. Here's her card. You should call her. And I took the card, and eventually I did call her, and eventually I did study with her. And he, you know, by the time that I came back on the scene, you know, they were already divorced. But
divorced.
He was still,
He was working his way in.
He was still performing with her. So us dancers would perform her, and he would be one of the musicians. So there was nothing, no relationships.
You didn't answer my question, though. You danced around it. You did not answer the question that you brought up in your book. How do you feel about
all the women coming up to young women? Maybe I need to read that poem so everybody's clear. Shall I read something? I think it's time for me to read a poem.
All right, go ahead.
Okay.
Still didn't answer the question.
Well, I'm really here to talk about poetry, right? So
you put this in the book. You say it made you feel.
Well, that's why I'm gonna read. I'm gonna read something. That
oh, okay.
Is,
okay.
All
right.
So, I used to live in this apartment, and the manager would complain about my music being too loud, right? And she said, she would say, "You're in there playing that snake music." So this particular prose piece is called Snake Music Chronicles. And snake music referring to Egyptian or belly dance music, which is actually an African dance.
Mm-hmm.
So this first one goes, "I turned my head around, and there was Kareem sitting in the back row. Yes, that Kareem. I tried not to be so obvious, wanted to make sure it was really him, so I let some time pass and then just slightly turned my head. Yep, it was Kareem. Who would guess that we would see him at this out-of-the-way, hard-to-find venue for a belly dance show, of all things? But this is L.A. You never know who you might see and where you might see them." So the next prose piece goes like this. "It was just over 6 miles, pier-to-pier round trip. My legs told me, 'You're not running today,' so I obeyed. Walking was boring to me, so I turned up the music on my Walkman and zenned out as I became one with the waves and the passing seagulls. Enjoying the music, people watching, and just being, I noticed a rather rotund older man staring at me. I ignored him and went about my walk with a watchful eye. Living by the beach as I did, you learn not to entertain the roving eyes or catcalls of strangers and drunks, too close to home for invited drama and uninvited danger following me home. The sunset was a hue of deep blues and violets turned. The sunset was a hue of deep blues and violets tonight on my walk back. My shoes off, I felt the rush of cold water on my feet and legs. More folks had come out to see the purple majesty of sky. I again noticed the rotund man. Then I saw him getting up, walking towards my direction. Oh, shit, is his sister going to have to go Oya on his ass, I thought to myself. I see him talking to a woman. Next thing I see, this woman is waving at me. What the hell, I'm thinking. I turn my music off as I continue to walk on the water's edge. The woman proceeds to wave me down, walks to the edge to the wet sand with a piece of paper in her hand. Excuse me, my dad wants to talk with you. He's a drummer. Are you a dancer? Okay, that's a new one. Next thing you know, he'll be inviting me up to his place to dance, I'm thinking. What? I question the woman. She says, my dad saw you and wants to speak with you. He doesn't mean any harm and didn't mean to scare you. My mom has a dance group, and he thought you would be good in the group. I'm not scared. It's just unnerving to have some stranger staring you down, then waving you down while you're minding your own business. At that point, the man had walked up. He introduced himself, gave his apologies for interrupting my walk, but said he had to let me know something. Then he said, "Young lady, I saw you walking up the beach and then back down the beach, and I said I must tell her what I see before she leaves." And I said, "And that would be what exactly?" Then he said, "I'm a classical musician. I play Middle Eastern music, the oud, the frame drum, and piano. I've been playing for years. My wife is a classically trained Egyptian dancer." Stunned and a bit flattered, I said, "Yes, I dance. I do West African Nigerian dance and Brazilian samba. I never thought about belly dance." "Yes, well, you should think about what I'm saying. You would be wonderful. Here's my wife's card. Call her when you're ready." I thanked him for making me feel like the girl from Ipanema and finished my walk. Years later, not only was I taking dance classes with his world-renowned dancer, educator, and by then ex-wife, I was going to the lavish show she had at her house, where she had a whole orchestra playing North African and Arab music into the wee hours of the morning. Oh, and her ex-husband was there too, playing and grooving to the music with us dancers. Now I'll leave it there.
Okay.
So that is that story that you made reference to.
Michonne, you have a question?
I do, but I want to go back to Orisha.
Orisha.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So do you practice African spirituality? Personally,
I practice African spirituality, but not in the Orisha tradition. I've taken classes, and I used to go to a temple years ago, but I am more in the Kemetic tradition, and
okay.
I do
make
parallels between the West African deities and the Egyptian deities as well.
Kemet and which has come out of Kush. I heard about Kemet.
Okay, is Santeria an offshoot of that?
Santeria, yeah, in Cuba it's called Santeria, and in Brazil it's called Candomblé.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I know that there's some other offshoots of that as well, but they all come out of that West African Orisha tradition.
Okay. Do you or have you ever planned to take part in their initiation?
I have taken part, actually, in some ceremonies and rituals, and I was really honored to be a part of that. And I'm not sure if I'll pursue it or not.
Okay. Do you have any abilities, like you can read people or auras or anything?
Well, I used to be a massage therapist, and my next book is actually going to be talking about holistic health and healing and energy healing. So I would say that my abilities are more so in the healing field, healing area.
Okay.
Did your second mom, what kind of stories did she tell you about being in the Black Panther Party?
She would just tell me, I mean, that's not something that we really talked a lot about. I know that she was part of the free breakfast program that they had,
uh-huh.
because they
uh-huh.
had it down here as well as, you know, up in the Bay Area. But yeah, that is actually something we didn't really talk a lot about.
I saw that you made a lot of analogies and parables to track. Are you an ex-runner?
I am. Well, I shouldn't say I didn't run in competition, but I used to do 5 and 10 Ks.
Wow. Yeah, I picked that up. I picked that up. I said,
yeah.
Wow. It seemed like she used to be a runner, because I see some parables that you wrote.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad that you saw that, because that's what I wanted, the kind of running thread, no pun intended, through the book. I'm glad you picked that up. In fact, why don't I read, since you mentioned that, let's talk about the track meets.
Yeah.
Fine.
That was the big thing in your area, the track meet.
Oh yeah, that was. And that's part of LA and I think even in other parts of the country that people, the younger generation, missed out on that, right? So this one's called the track meet.
We still got track programs in this country. And, you know,
yeah, but it's
just that
the
folks from the islands are just beating us in the sprint. And, you know, but we still, the United States is still competitive. In the track, you know, and I don't know if they're going to have
popular
Olympics next year. We were supposed to have the Olympics in Japan this year, but it says postponed
mm-hmm.
to next year. But I don't know. Not if Biden
right.
the country down for 6 to 8 weeks.
Right. So let me read this one since we're talking about running. It's called the track meet. I learned how to people watch at the track meet. Before there was going to the mall, online dating, meetups, computer games, cell phones, or even computers, there was the track meet. Everybody came out to the track meets. The whole school, the whole neighborhood came to the track meets. It was a family thing, but it was definitely the place to be seen. You know how we black folks do, and we do it with style and flair. Hot pants or culottes and high heels for us ladies, preferably the kind that had those Roman sandal straps that you tied all the way up your thighs. Leather jackets and fur coats. This was long before PETA. Guys with multicolored suede or leather hats cocked to the side. Boots and dress slacks with your school jacket, but never sweatpants or tennis shoes, unless you were on the track team, of course. Black folks strutted and paraded in between the races, that is. Otherwise, you better sit your butt down and don't block the view of the track. After all, we were there to watch guys like Jerry Proctor, Harold Busby, Lee Evans, Tommy Smith, and John Carlos do their thing. From the Mount SAC relays to Modesto, Fresno to Berkeley, to round the corner at SC and UCLA, folks got in cars, hitchhiked, and carpooled to travel up and down the state to get to the track meet. Back in college days, there were always parties after the track meet, and we would travel far and wide for a party, especially a house or dorm party. One track meet stands out in my mind as a child. The meet was at John Muir High School, and their drum corps had just performed. They were renowned for their playing, and we called them our West Coast answer to Grambling and to the rest of those Southern drum corps. They even performed at the Rose Parade. I was there with my family, and there was the usual excitement about the relay races, the hurdles, long, triple, and high jump competitions. Right in the middle of the track meet, there was a buzz. that happened throughout the field, a murmur, a hum. Did I just hear somebody start crying? Then an eerie quiet on the track. The track announcer said, "We have some sad news to announce. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Has been shot and killed. This meet is over. Please, everyone, go home, please." A collective gasp of, "Oh my God," filled the high school from the track field to the stadium seats. I remember an older white couple sitting next to my family. The white man said to his white female companion, perhaps his wife, "We better get out of here now." Just a child, I really didn't understand the historical weight of what was just announced. I remember my mother taking me by the hand and our family rushing out to our car. The voices of grief in that stadium, on the track field, in my mother's and father's voices on the ride home, would be seared into my memory as we watched the TV news and saw a nation crying with fire in its eyes. And that is about the track meet.
Yeah, that was the...
And these are true stories.
That was the sad... That was a sad day for Black America. If anybody have a comment or question, just press one. What was going on in your life when you wrote Systematic Dreams Over the Rainbow?
You know, as a writer and a poet, you never know what's going to trigger a poem. And believe it or not, the story behind that is I was, that particular poem is about the images of Black women in media, and that was that particular piece of writing actually inspired the idea that I would have the Orishas guiding the reader through the book, because uh-huh. I was like looking at, you know, all these different images that we have for Black women, as I said, in the media. But I thought, you know, we have stuff in our own culture. We have our own superheroes and sheroes. We have our own
and
story.
And Foxy Brown,
you know,
is yours.
Exactly. And I said, you know what? Let's talk about the Orishas and let's guide people to that. So, would you like me to read that?
No. What I want to ask you is, since you brought up that, see, I like that poem, The Rainbow, but you talk about that was about images of Black women. What do you think are images of Black women today in 2020, in the 21st century?
Personally, I don't think the image is... go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, personally, I really don't see that the images have really changed that much. I studied film when I was in college, TV film production, and, you know, most of these film schools, they trot out the film Birth of a Nation, the first film, Birth of a Nation, the white racist Birth of a
mm-hmm.
Nation film.
About Ku
and,
Klux Klan.
Yeah, exactly. And that film set all the stereotypes that you see currently, that film set the standard for the stereotype of Black people. And I don't really see that those images have changed that much. So that's you know, my take on it. I thank goodness that we have more conscious Black filmmakers. But still, you know, we have to be careful, because I've even seen, you know, Black filmmakers and Black media that it's like, you know, if a white person had done this production, we'd be out picketing and boycotting.
Yeah. So yeah. It's always negative. And, you know, like some of these TV shows and movies, I'm talking about Black men. I don't see not one positive Black man on these shows and movies that are done by Black producers. We either scheming, selling drugs, getting high, cheating on our women, beating on our women, not taking care of family. And that's why when other cultures come over this country, they have negative perception of our culture, Black Americans. And that's and you got to think the five powerhouses that run media in the world. Let me, Sean. I know you got a question.
Okay. I want to know, like, when did you know that you were going to actually write a book that, you know, besides just a thought, when, like, I have to do this?
I'm not really following your question. Say that again.
Okay, like, did you know, like, some people say, oh, I always knew I was going to write a book. Or did something happen, or you said, oh, you know, like, did you have this burning desire to do it? And it's like, I'm going for it, or... how did all that come about?
Okay. Well, I've been writing stories since I was like 6 years old, right? So I knew writing was always something that I did, even when worked all different kind of other jobs. I always would write. Poetry is something that's new to me, because my training has been more so in journalistic type writing, non-fiction type writing. And
what's the difference between fiction and non-fiction? I get confused sometimes. Which one is the real one?
Non-fiction
is the real one. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So fiction is something you just make up in your head, right?
Yeah, fantasy.
So coming from a journalism background, where I would, you know, write related to what's going on, you know, whether it was a story, a personal interest story about a person in the community, right, or a problem in the community, or maybe it's just writing an op-ed piece, giving my opinion about a particular situation. So that's a different kind of writing than the whole creative writing thing. I've written stories before, but the actual craft of poetry is something that I didn't go to school for. So when the opportunity came to take a class in developing my poetry skills, because there's a place in here in LA called the World Stage. Some people may have heard of it. It is like a cultural center where creativity is just—it's an incredible place that nourishes creativity. Whether it's music, we've got African drumming going on there, jazz performances, singing. It's just an incredible cultural center here in Leimert Park in LA, in the Crenshaw area, right? So
Crenshaw.
I had been going in the Crenshaw area.
Yeah, they made movies
and so
about
I
Crenshaw.
Had been, yeah, there's all kind of In fact, Issa Rae, with her Insecure show, has been all throughout, like their broadcast and show, you know, Leimert Park and all that whole area. But yeah, the stage was a place that I kind of started going to, and when the opportunity to really develop my poetry more came up, and I was like, yeah, you know, I had been writing poetry for a while, and I said, yeah, I want to learn more, because as I said, I didn't go to school knowing even what the rules of poetry are, the different kinds of poems you can write and all that. So it was a great opportunity, and in cooperation with the World Stage Press is the class called Community Literature Initiative, and they're really about fostering the community voices. And so they had the opportunity to publish community people in the community that take the class, and I said, yeah, I want to do that. And so that's how this particular book came about. I actually had a manuscript that was going to get published, and unfortunately that didn't happen, so now I've got to go back and re-edit that particular project.
So
that's the story of this book.
Okay. I got a question for both you and Michonne, and which has come from one of your poems too. Have any one of you been called an angry black woman? Y'all didn't hear the question?
I heard it.
Yeah.
Oh, that was dialing on me like, whoa. I thought something was wrong with the connection.
Yes.
She got like six packs.
Yeah, I've been called it.
About being an angry black woman. I want to know, have any one of you been called an angry black woman?
Yes, I
have.
Both of y'all been called
angry black? But it was by another black person and a black male.
Really?
Yes. Oh.
Yeah, I've been called that too. Yeah, I don't think the white person would have enough
to do it
to my face. They may have thought it, but they didn't say that.
Well, are y'all angry black women? Be honest.
Okay, I want to be honest.
I know Michonne can get a lot
do
angry.
Make me angry.
I make you angry?
No, I said certain things do make me angry. But
well,
those
you know,
same certain things could probably
ahead.
Make anybody angry, regardless if they were black or not.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Sister Koshi. What makes you... Why people think you're an angry black woman?
Well, you know, there's a quote by James Baldwin that I don't have off the top of my head.
He's mentioned a lot, man. He should be one of, like, the top American writers of all time.
Oh, yes, he is. He is. I'm going to have to paraphrase the quote because I don't remember it exactly, but it's something like he was said that if you're a rational thinking person, black person in America, you will be in a constant state of rage and anger. So I think that answers the question. I think what we have to do is find creative ways to deal with our anger and our rage, and I think writing is one of those ways that you do that. You know, this term self-care is really popular now.
Yes,
and
in the last three to five years, self-care. Yeah, that's a biggie now.
Right.
In the holistic wellness
right.
community.
Right. And I think one, like I said, I think one way of self-care is writing, whether it's a journal, whether it's writing a book, a script, or whatever, is write. You know, whether it gets published or not, whether anybody sees it or not, just write. And I think that that is one of the tools that we can use to deal with our anger. And again, creativity, however that looks, whatever that looks like. I think.
Do you have any writing workshops? Do you have any writing workshops that you do, that you conduct in the community for young folks?
Not right now, but I am looking at ways that I can get more involved with creating literacy and reading and writing in the community. Whatever that looks like. So that's something that I'm definitely interested in. I talk a little bit about Cuba in this book because I went there a few years back. And, you know, Cuba has a 99.9% literacy rate, right? So you got educated folk over there. And there's what's our excuse over here?
Well, I could tell you. I could put it all in a nutshell, that's a rhetorical question.
I mean,
of the educational system are very negative in the black. We really don't have black communities like we used to have. But where there's a predominantly black population, that school system is not up to par. Also, They're not teaching our kids the sciences, the technology, the engineering that's needed in our communities and in this country. Also, they teach our kids how to get a job instead of becoming owners and ownership and entrepreneurs and this is the thing that I have bear witness to. In the third grade, a black boy wanted to be like, let's say, a fireman. By the time he reached the sixth grade, 11, 12 years old, he don't know what he want to be any longer. That is our education system in our community is very self-destructive to our youth. And now, we have no excuse, because we have a lot of black superintendents. We have a lot of black principals. We have a lot of black educators. What are they doing in the school system teaching our own children? And what they're doing is, I hate to say, they are representatives of white supremacy. And with that, everybody, I want y'all to get this book. We only got a minute left. The Orisha Talks. Tales of Lust, Love, and Her Historical Memory. Sister Kochi, I appreciate you coming on the show. I enjoy the conversation because the whole month, all of our shows have been very tense, very focused on what's going on in our country. So tomorrow, what's going on with your program, Michonne?
Well, tomorrow, I was going to be talking about the strengths and challenges that we face as black people.
Okay. I'm just glad that tonight I was able to break away from the intensity. So next week we probably be back. But I'm glad of the poetry. I enjoy your work. And we have to stay in contact.
Thank you.
With that, everybody, thank you for tuning in. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. And that, you know, we really have to look how we worship and our belief system, our value system, and we really have to get back down to our culture basis. And with that, everybody have a nice week. I see you next Tuesday.
Hold it now!